From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food.
It was the biggest, funnest surprise of this research trip for me.
That's Bill Addison. He's the restaurant critic for Eater, and he's talking about Kamuri Tatsuya in Austin, the Japanese Texas spot made his new listicle, the 12 best new restaurants in America.
The concept is Japanese Texas izakaya, so basically almost bar food with a great drinks program, but that really melds the cuisines of Texas and Japan. And I was absolutely skeptical. I frankly almost skipped even going to this restaurant, but the local Eater Austin editor really liked it and encouraged me to go. We went together. I like started taking forkfuls of this takoyaki, which is octopus fritters, but with like cheese and beef chili melted over it. It's all crazy. Like guacapoke, you know, things that sound really stupid, right? I'm sorry to say. And ramen that has smoked brisket in it, but you taste it and you're like, I'm happy. And that's really the bottom line when it comes to good cooking and restaurants.
Pretty much. and I'm sure that you have rules. For instance, what time frame did the restaurants need to open in order to make the list?
I do have rules. So I give myself a May to May window every year now. So these restaurants we're talking about today all opened between May 2016 and May 2017. And I like that month of May gives some restaurants some wiggle room. Sometimes, you know, a restaurant that did open May 16 that might have not been quite ready for the best new restaurant list last year might get a chance to get on there this year.
Yeah, I think it's a really good time frame. And you do 12. Why 12?
I just picked 12 this year because that's the number that really felt compelling. The last 2 years that I've done this list, we each had 21 on the list. A dozen just felt right. And I think we felt good about it. For me, having less of them, first of all, I'll say I liked the breadth of having a larger number and I liked feeling inclusive about this. But then my editors and I decided we would pick a smaller number this year, and it helped me really nail down which ones were most compelling to me and why.
What distinguishes those that don't make the cut?
Ah, great question. Let's say in Chicago, there were two restaurants that were very close for this list, and one is just a real gift to the city. It's a place called Giant, serving just wonderful, very broadly American food with a chef who really knows what he's doing. But then there was this restaurant, Elski, that serves new Nordic cuisine, but with kind of a Midwestern warmth to it as well. And I just felt ultimately that if I'm thinking nationally, that Elski brought more to that conversation than Giant did. Although, if you're in Chicago, I certainly encourage you to visit Giant, too.
So let's start with Elski. It's interesting to me that you say Nordic cuisine with the warmth of the Midwest, since the Midwest has such a link to to Scandinavia.
Yeah, I think I mean warmth in terms of hospitality and range. There is this sort of homey, very American thread that runs through some of the food at Elski. And, you know, some of it has that kind of wonderful starkness of new Nordic cuisine, lots of dill, lots of trout, astringent vegetables like asparagus. Then also I might find an artichoke stew that just felt like the American spring and kind of warmed me in just the right way when I was there.
Okay, so now let's move on to New York City's The Grill.
Yes, it's the most over-the-top restaurant to open in Manhattan, probably in the last 15 years. It's from the major food group, the restaurant group behind Carbone and a lot of other hits in New York. They didn't really reinvent the space so much, but what they're reinventing is that continental mid-century style of service, that tableside flamboyance where they may cut prime rib to order or make an omelet tableside or finish the meal with something flambéed that kind of merges Cherry's Jubilee and Peach Melba. But the thing is, so much of that food can just be show, can just be theater. but it all tastes really good. They have nailed it. It's so much fun. The one thing I should say is that when it was the Four Seasons, it was just the epitome of the power lunch. But I really think that dinner is the move now.
Surprisingly, one of your picks is in a hotel in Houston.
Yes. You just have to ignore the beige lobby of the Marriott Marquis in downtown Houston and walk right into this like kaleidoscope of great food from Hugo Ortega and his wife Tracy Vaught. They run several fantastic restaurants in Houston. Hugo's is his most well-known, and Hugo Ortega won the James Beard Restaurant Award for the Southwest this year. I don't know. I think this is their best one yet, honestly. If somebody went to Houston and said, I only have time to eat at one of Hugo's restaurants, I would send them to Sochi, this newest restaurant of theirs that homes in on Oaxacan food. There are some great masa-based dishes that you don't really see too much of anywhere in the country. I would say, of course, that Los Angeles is probably the place where you can find most of the great Oaxacan food and restaurants in America, but Sochi gives L.A. a run for its money in this one.
And of course, L.A., we made the cut with one.
Yes.
And that one is?
That one is Felix Trattoria in Venice. Oh my gosh, what a great meal. You know, there's a lot of Italian happening in L.A. right now. Rosso Blu, Pizzana.
Cosa Buona.
Cosa Buona, thank you. But I really felt like Evan Funke's pastas just stood out, not only in the city that's having this big Italian moment, but everywhere that I ate pasta in the country last year. It was just some kind of good. I love that his menu travels all over Italy, but doesn't feel disjointed. They all have this through line of excellence that kind of doesn't make it seem too weird that there's a Roman cacio e pepe next to a much more saucy, robust Southern Italian pasta. It all works together.
Find a link to Bill Addison's 12 best new restaurants in America on our website. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood. Next, we talk to an author who looks at stories of famous women through food. That's when the show continues. Stay with us.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleinman. You are what you eat, the old adage goes, but time, place, and circumstance influence what's on our forks, who we share meals with, and whether the food gives us pleasure or mere sustenance. In her new book, What She Ate, Laura Shapiro explores the lives and diets of six notable women. You say that every life has a food story and every food story is unique. Why these particular women?
Well, when I got this idea, I started looking for women who had something unknowable. Other biographies had been written about these people, but I thought if I used food to look at their lives, I could get someplace that other biographies hadn't gotten. I wanted people with a little mystery, some little thing in their lives that I just didn't get otherwise. Some of the women I had been interested in for a long time, and others I kind of auditioned for this project.
We should say that the six women that you focus on are Eleanor Roosevelt, Helen Gurley Brown, Eva Braun, who I'm sure everyone knows those three, and perhaps the lesser known Barbara Pym, who was a 20th century British author, Dorothy Wordsworth, the sister of the famous poet, and Rosa Lewis, the woman that many people might know from the PBS series, The Duchess of Duke Street.
Yes, so some of these women were, but they were all well-known in their time, and some of them are still well-known in ours. I needed to have women who stood out from the crowd, women who did have a kind of public life because they were the ones who were going to have acquired some kind of paper trail, a document trail that I could actually pursue for like the breadcrumbs of food that would be mentioned here and there. Every life does have a food story, but we might never know that food story because most people don't tell it. They don't write it down in their diaries. If they even leave a diary, it's not in their letters. So that was a kind of limiting factor for the women I chose.
Let's start with Eleanor Roosevelt for obvious reasons. I mean, what an interesting person. Could you tell us who she brought in to cook at the White House?
Well, Eleanor was put in charge of the domestic side of the White House. FDR asked her to take that over. And so for that purpose, she went out and hired a housekeeper. Now, you would think that you would hire somebody who had run a hotel or somebody who knew something. But she invited a woman named Henrietta Nesbitt, who was a neighbor of theirs up in upstate New York near Hyde Park. This was a woman she had gotten to know in Democratic circles. She was a woman who had an out-of-work husband and two grown children. It was the Depression. She could use a job. Eleanor liked her. This is how Eleanor was, you know. Here's a nice woman who needs work. She's raised a family. Surely she can run the White House. So she brought her to Washington to do this. And, you know, it was a nice gesture on her part, but Mrs. Nesbitt was completely unqualified.
Yes, from what I read, her food was truly awful.
Well, she had cooked for her family in the style of 1920s and 30s America, middle-class mainstream cooking. It was not a great era in American cuisine. And her imagination also went to the kind of tea room, ladies' lunch type cookery. And another factor, and this is really important, FDR put the kitchen on a very tight budget. It was the Depression, and then after the Depression, it was war and rationing. So Mrs. Nesbitt, to be fair, she did not have a lot of money to spend. But as you know, women without a lot of money to spend have been making very good meals for their families since time began. She's not one of those women. She went to the books and the menus and the ideas that she had for economical cooking. And then she, as somebody who worked in the White House said, you know, Henrietta did not do the cooking herself. She simply stood over the cooks and made sure that they did as bad a job as possible. So to begin with, you had a dish like creamed chipped beef on toast. I think it's probably possible to make that taste good, but you need good cooking and it has to come out fresh and it has to look nice on the plate. And none of this happened. So there are all these descriptions of the food that comes out. She would put lamb on the menu, lamb and string beans. Nothing wrong with this as a menu. The lamb was so dry, gray, and overcooked that when people then wrote home, they said, guess what? Had dinner at the White House and we had this overcooked mutton. That's how bad it had been. Nobody recognized it as lamb. And the vegetables were famously soggy and miserable looking. So it was one disaster meal after another.
So one has to ask whether or not this was some sort of bizarre strategy to make sure that the face of the White House, when it was entertaining, didn't seem to be flying in the face of the challenges that the citizens of the United States were having to deal with.
That was very much part of it. Eleanor said, you know, she's interviewed before they moved into the White House. She was interviewed and asked what all first ladies are asked, what are you going to cook? What's the food going to be? And she always said, it's going to be very simple. We don't have a lot of money to spend on the food. It's just going to be plain food, well-cooked. People will have to be satisfied with that. She was very eager to have the White House be a kind of demonstration project for good economical cooking. And she herself, that social conscience that was such a huge part of her, the idea that people could look at the White House and see people, you know, flinging their champagne glasses over their shoulder and the truffles and so forth. She wasn't going to have that. She approved of these very, very simple, very plain menus. But the real question, as I said, is the cooking is so bad. That's what made it terrible. That's where you have to look into Eleanor's kind of mixed motives as the doyen of all this.
So one has to imagine that knowing about her husband's extracurricular activities and the largesse with which he might dine in that context of being away from her, away from the White House. Do you think that part of the reason that she decided to make the White House food so kind of penurious was in the face of Franklin's betrayal?
Well, he had a taste for luxury. He had been raised with luxury. He had been raised with wonderful food. His mother was a great cook and knew a lot about food and always had a wonderful cook in their kitchen in Hyde Parks. He had been raised with the best. And that was the aspect of him that she liked least from the get-go. And then when you add to that his infidelity, it got to seem to her that there's this whole side of FDR that is not the kind of great warrior for the Democrats with the great president that we know, the author of the New Deal and all that. That's what she loved and rooted for. But he had this other side. And she wanted to starve that other side. That's what I think. That is not a side of him that she wanted to feed. She hadn't wanted to be in the White House in the first place. She wanted to work with her friends in the various progressive movements and causes that she was in. And she loved living in New York and doing all these great things for the Democrats and for local populations and communities. So the idea of moving to the White House and dressing up and making small talk with people for hours on end did not appeal to her at all. So this was not a job she had chosen. And by the time they moved to the White House, you remember, he had had this affair with Lucy Mercer. The marriage had almost ended. She had agreed to keep it together and to stay with him because he asked her to. But as far as she was concerned, the marriage was really over. Well, that meant that in that whole personal feminine side of her life, she felt like a failure. She felt she had lost her husband, that her children, who were really much closer to their grandmother, FDR's mother, than they were to her. She felt she had made mistakes with them. She was not comfortable with that side of herself. But the managerial side, the hardworking side, the social justice side, that was strong and powerful. So that's what came across in the food. And if he didn't like it, and he didn't, and he complained often and to anybody who would listen, too bad.
But she did have friends, and she did have a life separate from the White House. Was her food life more robust and more sort of life-affirming, separate from her life with FDR?
Yes, and that's the wonderful thing. You know, if you have a soft spot for Eleanor Roosevelt, and I certainly do, you hate thinking of her going through life on these bland, awful meals forever. And the fact is, she didn't. She did have friends. She loved her women friends who were, as I say, these progressives, these feminists, these suffragists now who were trying to take the vote and really run with it and really change the world. She was close to a lot of these women and worked with them. That was her tribe. Those were the people with whom she was happy. So when she spent a weekend with them, took a walk in the country, helped them, she didn't do much of the cooking, but she would sort of be in the kitchen while they put together a little meal for themselves. She would write very warmly and affectionately about food in that context. And you see her at those times really seeing food in the light that we who love food love to see it. It's the thing that brings us together and brings out happiness. And then there's a wonderful thing that she wrote about in a few letters where she and her longtime secretary, who was always with her, went up to spend a few days with an old friend of hers, a former bodyguard. Now, there are people who think that she had an affair with this bodyguard. I don't know if they did, but if they did, it was not going on at this time. She was first lady and she was with her secretary. But at any rate, this guy was moving into a new house and she and the secretary were helping him get things set up. And she's very happy in this situation. She is close to this man, loves him dearly, and her secretary is one of her favorite people on earth. And the three of them were having a great time in this house. And she says she baked biscuits. She made popovers. She made an applesauce cake. This is Eleanor Roosevelt, who the whole world thinks is so austere and would never allow a delicious morsel to pass her lips. But she's baking a little applesauce cake for people she cares about. I just love this. I love thinking of food making her happy.
Let's turn to Barbara Pym. She is so interesting, and how you set up the reputation of British food at the time compared to what she describes in her novels is really interesting.
This fascinated me. You know, I've been reading Barbara Pym's novels. She published in the 50s and 60s mostly, some after that. But the novels that we really associate most with her are within a decade or two after World War II. This is not a time anybody reminisces fondly about in terms of the food. All you ever hear is how terrible it was from people who lived through it, and also in novels and memoirs and everything else. So it is astonishing to see in these books that people are cooking lovely things, and it'll be a beautiful classic French dish. It'll be a very simple but perfect salad, just a little olive oil, a little fresh lettuce, a glass of wine. These kinds of lovely meals are all over the books. So are the sort of classically terrible British meals that we all know about, the heaps of soggy vegetables, the desserts swamped with custard, and all the really heavy, stodgy, awful things that the British are famous for. So there was a whole spectrum of post-war food in Britain. And what's wonderful about Barbara Pym is that she loves the spectrum. It was the spectrum that defined Englishness. And that's what she loved, and that's what pours through her novels, is this tremendous fondness for Englishness, the English in all their wonderful, wonderful characteristics. As I say, the novels are full of food. And then her own diaries and notebooks are also full of food, because she was very interested in it. And this is why I think that that these books force us to rewrite the history of British cuisine, because of Barbara Pym's particular approach as a novelist. She was not a fantasist. She was not sitting there making the stuff up. She used to go to Lyons Corner House, one of those great cafeterias that were so popular. She would sit there with a little notebook. She would watch what people put on their trays. She would watch them sit down at a table. She would eavesdrop on what they said to each other, and she would watch how they ate and assess it, and she would find her characters there. Or she'd go to some wonderful tea shop where the cakes were delicious and the scones were so fresh and hot. She would describe that too. In other words, the food in the books is the real food, good and bad. It's real. I am convinced of that.
There's this marvelous juxtaposition you make of a British dish of boiled chicken with white sauce that Julia Child describes in a letter to her friend, Devoto. The same dish is described by Barbara Pym in one of her books, and they could not be more different.
Yes, this is so fascinating. And this is what got me thinking, you know what, maybe British food, the awfulness of it is at least partly just reputation and not reality. So Julia Child and her husband, Paul, were making their first trip to England, and they were driving around. They were then a few years later reminiscing about this trip. And so she wrote back to Avis Devoto and said, back in Cambridge, and said, you know, I remember our first trip. We stopped at this inn that was very, as she said, oldie-woldie, and we were given a classic British dish, she said, boiled chicken with white sauce. And she said that chicken was so plain, it still had the hair on. They had not pulled the pin feathers. She said the white sauce was, you know, that library paste kind of white sauce. She said, I always thought this was just a cliche, but it was the real thing. It was just as bad as I always thought it would be. I believe that Julia was telling the truth. There's no reason for her not to be. But that same dish appears in Barbara Pym's first published novel, Some Tame Gazelle, where these two sisters live in a nice little village in Britain, and they're not super rich, but they live nicely and comfortably, and they're constantly serving dinner to visiting clergy. This happens a lot in Barbara Pym novels. And one of the dishes that comes back all the time is boiled chicken with white sauce, but they describe it as this delicate, lovely dish, the cream, a little hint of lemon. It sounds scrumptious. So it's the same thing, only it's well-cooked with a very nice chicken. It's right there. There it is, the cliche and the reality, the kind of precious, wonderful thing that is the good British dish within that.
Laura Shapiro's new book is What She Ate. Now let's find out where Jonathan Gold is eating this week. He's the Pulitzer Prize-winning food critic for the LA Times.
This is pretty old, especially by LA standards. We're going to Dantana's in West Hollywood, which has been open since 1964.
What made you decide to take a look at such a place?
Well, I actually hadn't been there since my junior, senior year of high school. When this girl I had a crush on, I took her to see, I think, McCoy Tyner at the Troubadour, which was mistake number one because it was not what she was into. I decided to go to Dantana's because it was next door and I'd always seen it. And so we walk over there. It turns out that her family are regulars. And they don't have things named for them on the menu, but she kind of knows everybody who has things named for her on the menu. And we get, you know, whisked to her usual family booth. It was a horrible date. I think I ordered spaghetti a la Caruso. I'm not even sure they have it anymore, but I didn't know it had chicken livers in it.
Yeah, I was going to say, doesn't it have chicken livers?
Which at the time I was not so much into. And then got the check and I was just stunned.
So was this time better?
This time was better. I didn't have a date who insisted on walking by herself to her house from the restaurant.
So, but it's interesting because when you think about what that restaurant in particular has gained in cachet amongst power brokers in the city between 1964 and now is considerable, legendary even.
Oh, yeah, it is. I mean, everything on the menu is named after somebody. Veal, Jerry Weintraub, or Scallopini, Carl Malden, or Chop Salad, Nicky Hilton. Though I still think that Jerry Buss got a raw deal with the shrimp scampi.
I wonder if it angered him.
No, I think he... That may be exactly the way that Jerry Buss liked his shrimp scampi. God bless him.
So how do you go about reviewing a place like this, which is not really known for the food?
The times I went, I went with a lot of people. And Dantana's is really fun. I mean, it's really hard to have a bad time there. You know, everybody's like a little bit loud, but not too loud. The music is sub rosa, but not like too sub rosa. It's not like corny. I mean, you're not going to find Dean Martin singing That's Amore, even though there are, you know, check tablecloths. Spaghetti as a side dish with every entree. From the second time I went in, they remembered what my drink was.
That's pretty impressive.
I thought it was great. I mean, I didn't like my drink especially.
It's not new wave cocktailing.
It's an old-fashioned, but the old-fashioned, not the cocktailian one, which meant that there's almost no bitters in it and there's like a fistful of muddled maraschino cherries. But I got it every time. The martinis are actually good.
I would imagine that's the way to go.
Yeah.
So what was your strategy for ordering?
Everybody says get the garlic cheese toast. So you get the garlic cheese toast, which is toast with garlic and sort of large amounts of cheese on it. Clams Casino, almost like a brick-like, stolid mozzarella marinara, but not unpleasant. You're not going to go there, you know, to have a debate about, like, white sauce, red sauce, American-Italian cooking. I mean, you know, this isn't trying to open a dialogue. It's just serving food for people who like it. So, you know, if you order a chicken Vesuvio, it's not the one you're going to have in Chicago.
What is chicken Vesuvio?
Here, it's chicken with garlic and white wine and potatoes. James Woods may not be the ultimate authority on what goes into chicken Florentine, but there you go.
Is it named for him?
Of course it's named for him.
Is this the kind of place that when you walk in, you have to palm the maitre d'?
Maybe it is, but I didn't. The maitre d' seems great. He actually told me that he used to work for you for a while. I think you fired him.
Yes, Christian. And little known fact, he also owns Olson's Deli on Pico.
That's great.
Yeah.
I think he's Swedish. People absolutely love the steaks and chops. And I would say that they're on the ordinary side. But if you tell some people that about the steak, Dabney Coleman, they will almost fight you.
Okay, what is the steak Dabney Coleman?
It's just a big steak. And it has a nice char on it. It's salted properly. If you order it medium rare, it's exactly the right temperature. You can get your side of spaghetti and tomato sauce or garlic oil alongside it. You could start off with a tita con salad, which is named for Sammy Con's widow.
Eventually, they're going to have to update these names.
I don't think so. I think that they have to be there forever. I sort of like the cannelloni, which are very much the old school kind, stuffed with a lot of meat.
To me, going into these kinds of restaurants is an antidote sometimes to the overly considered food bubble life that we live in.
People really like the food, and some of the food is really good. And there's a dish called Chicken Beckerman, named after a producer at 20th Century Fox. You know, both Dantana's and Mateo have this chicken, which is basically just baked chicken with garlic, onions that are melted down, but till they're really dark and crispy, almost like the onions on top of Mojadra.
Mmm, that sounds delicious.
And it comes with freshly made potato chips, like tossed with it. It's good. Everybody would be happy with that. You can get potatoes Beckerman, which is the dish without the chicken in it, if you're feeling in that kind of mood. Or you can get the chicken parmigiana, which is exactly what you expect from chicken parmigiana, which is to say a giant thing. It's super crisp. It's annealed under a thick layer of marinara sauce and melted cheese. It is exactly what it is.
So for dessert, did you have spumoni?
Of course I had spumoni. You have to have spumoni.
I wonder where they get spumoni. I mean, there's like probably one spumoni factory in America pumping it out.
I think you would be surprised how much spumoni there is in America.
What is spumoni for people who don't know?
Spumoni is a sort of mishmash of ice cream that includes chocolate, pistachio almond, and strawberry cherry. Besides the spumoni, the ice cream that people seem to be really excited about is the cappuccino ice cream, which comes with little bits of cappuccino candy in it.
Jonathan Gold, Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Times, takes a look at an old standard this week. It's Dantana's in West Hollywood. Text the words good food to 69866 to get Jonathan's restaurant recommendations. In a minute, we take a break from food to get the latest on trends in craft spirits, grain to glass. Stay with us.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
I'm Evan Kleinman, and you're listening to Good Food on KCRW. Long before Paul Hletko started distilling whiskey and gin, his ancestors owned a thriving brewery in Czechoslovakia. When the Nazis arrived, however, the brewery was lost. We called Hletko to hear how this family history informed the decision to open Few Spirits in Evanston, Illinois. Hi, Paul.
Hey, Evan. How are you doing today?
Good. First off, tell me about your grandfather and his business.
Well, my grandfather was still a kid back in the day, which is why he was able to end up surviving the camps. But, his family had a relatively major brewery outside of Prague a little bit. They were producing Pilsner beer for a substantial period of time when they were very well known for it. 1939, after the Nazis invaded, they, no longer did.
When you first got into the liquor business, how much of knowing about this legacy was involved in that decision?
I think it was a lot of it. I mean, it kind of, aside from the fact I've always wanted to be a creative person, and, that's always been what gets me excited to wake up in the morning, the ability to kind of reconnect over generations meant a lot to me. Making whiskey is an art, and it's, it's also a passion. It's also a business. But for me, what really kind of helps make all the hard times worthwhile is the family aspect. It really kind of helps connect with the legacy. I think that means a lot to me. My grandpa never got a chance to see Few even exist, much less kind of what it's become. But I think he'd be pretty proud if he had any opportunity.
Yeah, I'm sure. The name is so unusual. What does it mean?
The name Few is intended to kind of evoke the fact that we really just don't make a lot. You know, we really just make just a few products. We're small, we're high end. You know, we are handcrafted. But it's also true that we're located here in Evanston, Illinois, where the Prohibition movement, you know, it didn't necessarily start, but it really kind of took full force. The Prohibition movement was spearheaded by an Evanston resident named Frances Elizabeth Willard. And there are a lot of folks that notice a similarity between her initials and our name.
Sort of like a great finger in the eye.
Yeah, that's one way to look at it. Another way is that, you know, it's also kind of, to the extent that it's true, which of course it's a coincidence, you know, to me it's more of an honor. Miss Willard was an extremely intelligent, well-respected, well-read. She was an amazing woman who was well before her time. In fact, if she was the most famous woman, certainly in Illinois, if not the U.S. or even the world at the time. Actually, inside the U.S. Capitol, there are 50 statues in the rotunda representing the 50 most famous people from each state. And we're really proud that, you know, out of 50 statues, only one woman was ever deemed important enough to be part of the U.S. Capitol. You know, here in Evanston, we're really proud that that woman is Frances Willard.
You were a patent attorney before you decided to switch gears and focus on distilling. Did your legal background work in your favor?
Certainly, I think having the ability to think like a lawyer thinks is very advantageous. And, you know, it's been a strong advantage in several areas. That said, you know, there are many more days that I wish I was a plumber. If I could plumb a lot better, it'd be very handy from time to time. If I was a lot better of an electrician, that'd be pretty handy as well.
Getting into the distilling business, I mean, it's so foreign to me, and yet so many people are doing it. Is the path that's generally trod, you work for somebody and then you go out on your own, or did you have a mentor of some kind?
I think different people come at it from different ways, and yeah, I certainly worked with some friends, and nobody comes into the business sui generis, I guess. People come at it from different ways. I think it can be very challenging. Certainly at these days, the business is very different than when I started, even though that wasn't necessarily all that many years ago. The business has moved very, very fast.
Talk a little bit about that. What was it like when you first started compared to now?
We first started just basically 6 years ago. There's really almost nobody across the country or the world doing what we do. When we started, there were, maybe call it 40 to 60 people around the world doing what we do on this scale. Today, there's 30 in the state of Illinois.
Is it mostly a money move, do you think, driven by marketing and branding?
I think it's a little bit of everything. And I think there's an awful lot of people that take the approach that, hey, look at what craft beer did. It'll happen the same way in spirits. That's not true. But anyway, I think a lot of people see that kind of surface similarity and think that it's going to be an easy way to make a few bucks. The opposite is true. I mean, the best way to make $1 million in spirits is to start with two.
Yeah, shares a lot of similarities with the restaurant business. Do you think with what happened with Casamigos and George Clooney, this giant sale is going to just bring more people into the market?
I think most people are going to pretty readily recognize that the Casamigos deal is a little bit of an outlier. That deal was certainly a very good deal for the investors, but I'm not so sure that that is necessarily replicatable by people who are not movie stars or don't have that sort of fame to trade on. I think there are certainly deals out there that people are going to look at and go, hey, that could be me too. You know, you could look at like, you know, High West or Smooth Ambler or Westland, all of which were relatively substantial deals, but maybe not have that same eye-popping $1 billion.
Talk to me a bit about what you do at Few, what whiskey means to you, and compared to more old-line traditional whiskey companies, what you're doing.
I think at Few, what whiskey means to us is it's really, you know, liquid art in a bottle. And that's kind of how we see it. That's what we strive to create every day. You know, that's the interesting thing about, you know, the small distilleries like Few versus a large distillery. You know, a lot of times there's a lot of things that kind of get blurred. And, you know, the large distilleries tend to make some pretty fantastic spirit as well. So, you know, a lot of these comparisons simply kind of extend to, you know, what we do, how we do it, and how our stuff tastes in the glass. We don't make our stuff to taste like the big boys. You can't compete with the big boys on quality. You have to compete with them on taste and doing something a little bit different. And so that's kind of where we try to make our difference. We make our spirits like from a brewer's background. Yeah, we take the approach of making our spirit in the fermenter rather than in the barrel. Both ways are perfectly valid. This is just how we do it.
What does that mean, you make the product in the fermenter rather than in the barrel?
There's a bunch of different ways you can make whiskey, and the way we kind of do it is that we take a lot of great care in the fermenter. We carefully track our mash bills. We use particular yeast. We temperature control that fermentation in a way that many larger-scale distillers simply don't do. And by controlling the ferment the way that we do, it really helps to create the flavor that we are looking for, you know, coming off the still. A lot of other distillers will take the approach of going for a little bit higher yield in their ferment. And so they'll ferment at higher temperatures. They'll use yeast that have a little bit more alcohol tolerance so they can get a little bit more yield. And then they will produce their spirit and let it set in a barrel for a very, very long period of time until a lot of the defects in the fermentation kind of dissolve away.
You also make gin, and you make two different kinds of gin, one barrel gin and one you call American gin. Can you talk about gin as a product a bit and about how you approach these two different ways of making it?
Sure. Gin is the most glorious spirit out there because there's almost no rules. And so it allows for a great deal of creativity. You know, you can make your gin almost however you want, and you can make it bright, you can make it dark, you can make it dry, you can make it sweet, herbal, citrusy, whatever flavor you want, you can express that in gin. You know, for a person that really is trying to make kind of liquid art, gin is just a fantastic place to go because you can do whatever you want. And so certainly at Few, we have embraced that creativity. We've embraced that freedom. And you know, our primary gin products on the market are our barrel gin as well as our American gin. But if you follow us closely, you'll see we release an awful lot of different gins as well, ranging from a breakfast gin to boutique gins that are only available in the UK to collaboration gins done with record labels. You know, you can kind of see that creativity really kind of shine because of the freedom with gin.
Tell me about the gins that are only for sale in the UK. What tends to be their profile that makes them so well suited there?
You know, it kind of varies. Like, so recently we released what we call informally, it has a different name actually on the market, but we call it the Brexit gin because we had this gin recipe that had five different botanicals in it. Four of the botanicals kind of got together and voted the other one out because they didn't want it to be a part of it anymore. And so, you know, one botanical had to go away. And then the other botanicals really wanted to make sure that they were English enough. So they really cranked up the amount of lime. And so we ended up with an extremely limey gin that we sold exclusively in the UK, celebrating Brexit by voting out one of the botanicals.
So funny. When you're kicking back and you want to have a sip of something that isn't your own, what other American craft spirit would you reach for?
I reach for several. I mean, it's always a challenge because for the most part, I'm friends with all the other American craft spirits producers. But, you know, just sitting here in my study, you know, I'm looking at bottles of Widow Jane. I'm looking at bottles of Bren, looking at bottles of Blue Coat, Leopold Brothers, Parse Rum. You know, I'm looking at a bottle of Fernet Branca. You know, there's some really fun stuff in my library. And it's hard to pick a favorite, if only just because, you know, I'm friends with all these people as well.
That's Paul Huletko. He owns the craft distillery Few Spirits in Evanston, Illinois.
I mean, Bray as a word is from a sort of Scottish dialect. It means hillside. It means, you know, a gentle slope or hillside. And we are set on a hillside. And the funny thing was is that the area that we're in, the Otways, it's the Otway region of Victoria, so southwest of Melbourne, quite close to a very famous sort of landmark, the 12 Apostles. It's, yeah, large sort of rock formations out in the ocean on the coastline of Victoria. And a lot of international guests will come and travel down that road and, you know, take in the restaurant as well.
That's Dan Hunter talking about his restaurant, Bray. Bray sits on a 30-acre organic farm in Victoria, Australia. And just 4 years since opening, it's landed on the world's 50 best restaurants list. Hunter's also just published a book of recipes and stories from the restaurant. It's quite beautiful and called Bray. You describe your mom as an okay cook who didn't particularly like the activity. So you basically fell into cooking. That sounds pretty familiar to me. That's how I started too. Tell us more about your family's relationship to food and mealtime.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the point I was making in the book about that is that in comparison to some beautiful stories about people growing up and having, you know, the grandmother that was in the kitchen with them and the family recipes, we didn't have that. And my mum obviously fed myself and three siblings and all of us very well every day. And for us, it wasn't so much the act of eating, but certainly the act of sharing and the act of being that were the important things. So we always had to, as kids, be at the table at a certain time. My mum wouldn't let us start dinner until everyone was there. And it was a place where we could then, I guess, talk about the day, catch up with each other, depending on how old you were and things like that.
Did you actually join her to help in the kitchen at all?
Absolutely not at that stage. I was a, you know, a kid and then a teenage boy, played a lot of sport. Food was just something for sustenance, like meat, carbs. We certainly weren't involved in the cooking at that stage.
So how did you come to decide that you were going to get into the kitchen and apply for a job?
It just was more of a means to an end, to be honest. I fell into cooking purely out of the need to have money. And I just started as a kitchen hand. I started washing dishes in places. That led to the next level of, obviously, you know, someone was busy or had the night off or was going out the back for a cigarette or something, you know, some typical thing that happens in an average sort of kitchen. And can you do that for me? Can you put some food on the plate? Look how we do this. Maybe you could give us a hand. And then sort of progressing through that stage, those stages for a little while until actually a couple of years had passed. And then I sort of thought that it was something that I wanted to pursue at a more disciplined level or a more creative level, something where I thought I could learn something and actually contribute something in a good environment, a good cooking environment. So then at that stage, I sort of thought I should possibly do it as a career. And I sought out an adult kind of apprenticeship and working with someone in a restaurant.
And I understand that at that point, I believe it was around that point, that you actually went to the library and you checked out three books, The Joy of Cooking, Sophie Grigson's Meat Course, and Leith's Cookery School.
Yeah, so, I mean, I was living in the UK at the time and I'd, like, pretty much had probably spent 6 months to a year or something. It's a little bit, you know, it wasn't super important at that time, working in some cafes and some pubs and things like that. My wife and I were in England and we were travelling back from the Glastonbury Festival, actually a music festival, and we were going back to London and we were covered in mud and we basically got off the bus in Bath in the west of the UK in England and saw an ad for a job. We were planning on living there for a little while, saw an ad for a job looking for a chef to start at a pub there, and I went and applied for that. I did get the job, and then I went to the Bath Library and checked out three books, and which I still have today. I still have those books, actually.
I understand that it took you 4 years to find a spot that you felt was perfect to open your first restaurant. What was your criteria?
You know, we started by putting a ring on a map around Melbourne at 150 kilometres and then started to make a sort of secondary list based on what we required. And there were things like, you know, being near the ocean but not at the beach, being on a property large enough to grow food but not so big that you just became farmers and nothing else, you know, being near a nice town but not in the or on the main street of the town. So little things that allowed us to have some independence, some separation, but were all things that could contribute to a nice place and a culture and a population that could let something like what we wanted to do exist. And it really, you know, a lot of it came down to economics as well. Like, you know, we looked at many, many, many different sites over that time and some got close to meeting all the criteria, and often the ones that got closest were just too expensive for us, you know, so they got scratched. But we're luckily in sort of early 2013, a property went on the market that we thought was, you know, was a possibility. And once we did the sums and it met all the criteria, we're ready to take over.
You know, so much of more sophisticated restaurants' offerings can be challenging texturally. Can you talk a bit about texture
I think sometimes we don't realise the layman, the person who doesn't probably consider food in the way that maybe some of us who work in restaurants or eat in them regularly do. But texture is sort of the game with food, you know. Like, flavour is obviously super important, but sometimes different textures can get in the way of us understanding or even liking a flavour. Really, I've always been quite a textural cook. A lot of people do comment on the great different types of textures that they eat when they eat at Bray and eat my food. And so I always try and make sure there's a nice range of textures and things are balanced, much in the same way that you balance, you know, salt and sweet and acidity with something that's more savoury, things like that. We also try and make sure that we balance the textural range of what you can have with food.
One of the things you do for people who kind of might have a bit of an inability to cope is the way you ice the oyster.
Yeah. Look, iced oysters are a dish which has been on the menu for about 2 years, actually. The backstory is that we live close to the ocean and I always, and my daughter and I, we always get an ice cream when we go to the beach, no matter what, if it's winter, summer, whatever. And really going to the beach is really sort of an excuse to get an ice cream. And although people don't like the flavour of oyster or the texture, say, I've never met anyone who doesn't like the ocean or the smell of the ocean or, you know, the experience of being by the ocean. And I tried to incorporate those two things. And essentially what we came up with was transforming the oyster into an ice cream and putting it back into an oyster shell and presenting it to the guests as the iced oyster. And it is unusual. It has a level of sweetness to it, but so does an oyster when it's in season from southern Australia. A good oyster does have the flavour of a sweet ocean, some, you know, citric notes, some creaminess. And the thing that sort of gets people by, even though they might think it's unusual with the first mouthful, is that everyone loves ice cream.
I've been talking to Dan Hunter. His restaurant and new cookbook are called Bray. We close out the show at the Farmer's Market. Stay with us.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleinman. It's time for the Market Report. So over to you, Laura.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. I am sitting on a wall with Jill Davey, who is the chef over at the Mar Vista.
We're like Humpty Dumpty right now.
We are, but we're not going to fall off. And you are the former chef de cuisine at Josie. The Mar Vista is your latest restaurant adventure. So tell us a little bit about what you're shopping for today.
Well, it is the height of eggplant season for me, and my most favorite is Chinese eggplant.
Let's describe what a Chinese eggplant, and there's also the Japanese eggplant. Can you describe the difference?
Japanese eggplant has a little bit more of a hardier skin, kind of like the globes do. Mm-hmm. So like the Chinese eggplant, whereby it's really quite smooth and very digestible. Mm-hmm. But unlike the globe eggplant, the Chinese is delicious, and it's super tender, and it almost has this unique sweetness that I find to be extremely addicting.
And it's a long, very long, slender, beautiful, lavender eggplant.
Yeah, and you know, my friend Wilma up the way, she is one of my favorite eggplant growers. Mm-hmm. Honestly, she's got the best as far as I know, but she is so sweet. And God, these eggplants are so, I can't get enough of them. I love sauteing them. What I love to do is to slice them into like quarter inch rings. I'll toss them in olive oil. And the most important part is to get a sheet pan in the oven and get it up to temperature before you lay out all your rounds of eggplant. And then I slowly roast them like 350, just until they get a little kind of brown and crunchy. Mm-hmm. And they're the most addictive things. Like, I honestly have to make three times as much because I eat half of them.
Do you salt them before you put them in the oven?
You don't have to salt these. Okay. The Chinese eggplant, you do not have to salt. They don't have that bitterness. They really have this amazing, intense sweetness.
Okay.
And I particularly like to eat them in salads, and with heirloom tomatoes being, you know, at the height of the season right now, they are an amazing accompaniment to heirloom tomatoes. That's kind of one of my favorite go-tos. The other thing I have that goes on the salad is the melanzana. The melanzana are the larger eggplants, oh, which I char on the grill. So what I do is I cut them in half, and I put them flesh side down, and I char the flesh, mm-hmm, and then I turn them over, and I cook them on the skin side, mm-hmm, until they really give out, like, mm-hmm, they're really tender. Mm-hmm. Removing the skin, but leaving the charred flesh side on, mm-hmm, and then I'll puree that in a food processor with garlic, extra virgin olive oil, and then I finish it with shallots. If the eggplant is a little bitter, I add a little bit of sour cream to kind of offset the bitterness. But sometimes if you get them fresh and they're, you know, really at the height of the season, they tend not to be so bitter. It's a melanzana. It's like a spread.
Which has nothing to do with this salad.
Actually, it does. I put it on the base of the salad. It's a double eggplant salad.
Okay. That was Jill Davey. She's the executive chef at the Mar Vista, which is located on Venice Boulevard at Grandview. And she has love in the eggplant and making wonderful multi-layered eggplant dishes for us to enjoy. I'm talking now with Vilma Causey from Kingsburg. And Vilma is a longtime farmer. She and her husband, Alex. Rest in peace, Alex. He farmed for many, many years. And Vilma, you've been coming here with both summer fruit and with this wonderful Chinese eggplant that Jill was talking about. Why did you pick Chinese eggplant out of all the eggplant there is?
We went through so many varieties of eggplant, and this is the most popular now. For one thing, compared to an Italian, which is round, the Italian has a bitter taste to it. You have to salt it and wash it. This one you just cut and cook it.
Okay, and so how would you describe then the flesh on the inside?
It's much smoother, and it's really much better compared to a Japanese eggplant. Mm-hmm. A Japanese eggplant is a little bit firm, mm-hmm, and also porous. Mm-hmm. This one is kind of dense.
So it doesn't absorb so much oil.
Uh-huh.
Okay. And you also, you must have a good recipe you like with that. Do you use it in your traditional Filipino cooking?
Yeah, the one that I, which my husband really like, I call it Rilliano. And I roast the eggplant, take the skin out, flatten it, and then put a couple of eggs with a little salt if you want to, and just dip it and fry it or grill. My husband is one of those that say, she's cooking something, I'll throw it at the back door. But this one, he loves it. And I said, and I'm from the Philippines, but he eats it even breakfast. I said,
That sounds good. So you plant this particular variety of eggplant. Do you plant every couple of weeks so you have the harvest going all the way through?
No. This eggplant, you plant one time, and it takes you to the end. Like this one, I will be finished maybe by November. It's really a hot weather veggie.
All right, Vilma. Well, it's been great talking to you, and the eggplant is delicious.
Thank you. Cook you some Rilliano.
All right, thanks. That'll be tasty. I'd love to try that. That was Vilma Causey. She's a farmer from Kingsburg, which is in the heart of the San Joaquin Valley. She's been coming to this market since the early 80s. And she has Jill Davies' favorite eggplant. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
That's it for this week's show. If you missed any part of it, you can always listen to the show on our website, on KCRW's mobile app, or you can download our show wherever you get your podcasts. As always, many, many thanks to the Good Food team.
Laurel Garcia.
Joseph Stone.
Joel Stein.
Michelle Escobar.
And Ronnie Mickelson.
And I'm Evan Kleiman. I'll be back next week with more Good Food.